Hi, this is Joe Mama. You're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Jamie. Today, the annual Jaws of Justice Radio Legal Year in Review. Local attorneys David Bell and Robin Martinez are in to discuss their picks of some of 2018's most important stories and what they mean for you in 2019. Stay tuned for our calendar of events in the middle of the broadcast and the 420 drug war news at the end of the broadcast. Up next are David and Robin.
Good morning. This is Robin Martinez. I'm an attorney, a member of the National Lawyers Guild, and a partner in the law firm of Martinez, Tobin and Redmond. This is Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI 90.1 FM Community Radio. With me here today is David Bell. David is an attorney with the law firm of Wersch, Hobbs & Merakian.
Good morning.
Welcome, David.
Good morning.
Well, today we are going to give our, I guess, our retrospective of all of the big news in the world of law and the Supreme Court and major court decisions that came down over the past year. Before the show, we were talking about what some of the big stories were, and I think the biggest one has been the Supreme Court and the change that we've had in the Supreme Court.
Absolutely.
The Kavanaugh hearings were fairly riveting, but I guess the question is what do they mean in the larger context? Have you given much thought to that, David?
Yes, thank you. I think a few things. First, I felt that the hearings themselves, the tone, the nature both of how Justice Kavanaugh behaved and how I think some of the people on the panel behaved, I think demeaned the court in its entirety to where it almost starts to look like a political body, which maybe it always has been. I just had always hoped for and viewed it as something greater than or outside the purview of the political kind of day-to-day news cycle and things like that. And I think that caused me some concern. But the reality of it, and I think it's important for our listeners to understand, is when these decisions that are going to start changing in the type of in the way in which the court decides relative to how it was deciding before Kavanaugh will impact our listeners' lives. They won't feel that impact right away. It won't be a decision comes out today and a bolt of lightning comes out of the sky and strikes somebody. But what'll happen, it'll be large shifts in certain areas in our society that will eventually trickle down to the rest of us. And we will be impacted by these decisions.
I think that is absolutely right. And let's talk a little bit about sort of those shifts, maybe in a historical context of how the court works back and forth. But I think one of the things that struck me was when Kavanaugh wound up getting confirmed, it was the closest approval margin for any Supreme Court justice in history. It was a 50-48 vote. I don't think we've ever seen that. In fact, I think even some of the very liberal justices, for instance, Justice Sotomayor, who's currently on the court, she had a much, much wider margin of approval. Wow. And so in my mind, the partisan anger that bubbled to the surface during these hearings and, you know, sort of the tone and the conduct kind of leads me to believe that I think going forward, any kind of confirmation hearings that we have are going to be increasingly bitter. But you mentioned the credibility of the Supreme Court after these hearings. What impact do you think that these hearings have had on that credibility, and what's the significance of that?
Sure. So I think on these larger issues, we look to the Supreme Court as wiser individuals, older. They've been around longer. They're schooled in the law, hopefully schooled in life. And so for some of the larger legal issues that remain undefined in the law or need some type of clarification, we look to these individuals for advice. Not necessarily on how to behave in our own lives, but rather all of us have a stake in the law, and because that's how our society operates. We've all agreed to follow the law for the most part. And as a result of that, there has to be some expectation and some understanding of what the law is. If we are willing to put our confidence in a body, we want to make sure that body is motivated to make the right decision, whatever that means. I surely don't want that body to be viewed as making decisions based on what is politically expedient or who their friends are or who they know, because then our system here turns into many of the systems we see across the world that we look down upon, frankly.
Well, And I think that may be underscored, particularly with the Kavanaugh appointment, because, I mean, he was seen as being particularly partisan on the conservative side, but he replaced Justice Kennedy.
Right.
And the one thing about Kennedy was, even though he was a conservative justice, he was consistently seen as a swing vote. So while on, for instance, economic issues, he might have come down on a very, you know, sort of conservative, almost libertarian note, a lot of the times on social issues, he would go the other way and oftentimes side with the more liberal justices on the board or on the court. I think when I look at this from a historical perspective, I think really the significance of this last year is that we're now in a new era for the Supreme Court.
Correct.
And when you look at sort of the historical eras, you can go all the way back to the 1890s up to, you know, the time of the New Deal, where you had a very, very conservative court. It was known as the Lochner era. And I mean, all of us, you know, who've taken constitutional law, the Lochner era was kind of ingrained in our, and drilled into our brains. But what was fascinating about that time period was that the court struck down a tremendous number of federal, state, and local laws that the legislatures and the people were trying to enact to either check the influence of business or to just improve people's lives. And I kind of wonder if we're now going, you know, the pendulum has swung back to this idea of the Lochner era, because, you know, from the time of the New Deal, roughly about 37 to 1969, you had largely Democratic appointments to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court really went fairly, you know, liberal with the New Deal legislation, the civil rights era, you know, that culminated really under Chief Justice Warren. And, you know, since then, it's been a little rockier, do you think?
Absolutely. I think the major issue that I see here, and this is, again, broad brush, and we'll talk about specific cases, is the kind of the redistribution, not just of wealth, but of power in our country. And so, you know, under the Equal Protection Clause, everyone has the right to be treated equally under the laws, all persons, and that means we're all equal, whatever that means, but that's essentially. And so do we all have the same rights and obligations, and how do we assert those rights, and how are we held to those obligations? And what I see in the more conservative courts is you have more of a protection of big business or economic interests, which tends to go away from what I've just mentioned, at least in my view. And you have less protection for the individual and more reliance sometimes on the legislature and the whims of the legislature that go in and out of favor every 2 years when we elect a Congress. And so what you have is a push toward bigger business and let the executive branch figure it out. We are really not here to define the rights of individuals is essentially the theme that I see here. And I think we'll see that permeate throughout the court's rulings coming up.
When you mentioned the notion of due process and equality, what came to my mind was that famous line from George Orwell's Animal Farm, where one of the main characters basically says, well, we're all equal. It's just that some are more equal than others.
That's right.
And to me, it seems like that's what's going to happen now as we lock in this serious conservative majority. Because, you know, from the 60s, late 60s, up until recently, we had this sort of swing back and forth where you had Justices Powell, you know, O'Connor, and Kennedy, who were certainly, you know, conservative or tended to be that way, but they would swing back and forth and often side on social issues such as abortion, gay rights, affirmative action issues, for instance, with the more liberal wing of the court. But those folks are not there now, and now we've got a solid lock with Thomas, Alito, Roberts, Kavanaugh, and Gorsuch that are very, very conservative. And so, you know, I think you're right when you said earlier, this is one of these major shifts that we won't necessarily feel right away, but it's going to impact our lives for a long time to come.
Let me, if I could bring up one case in particular that I think typifies that, if that's okay. A case that's been argued by the Supreme Court, hasn't been decided yet, is a case called Gundy versus United States. And this involves registration of sex offenders at the national level. And what happened was in 2006, there's a federal legislation enacted to maintain a federal registry. And the question came up, well, what about the individuals that pled guilty prior to that and were sentenced for offenses now deemed registration offenses prior to 06? Do we go back and include them? And what's come out of that is, well, there was essentially a law passed that said the Attorney General can make that decision. And, of course, we have a retroactive application of federal law as to sex offender registration. Now, there's also state registration, and that's going to vary from court to court. But the part I want to bring to everyone's attention is, essentially, the Congress permitted the Attorney General to make a decision on whether sex offenders needed pled guilty or found guilty prior to enactment had to register as sex offenders. And just so we're clear, so everyone understands this, registration of sex offenders is horrifically oppressive. It's been ruled by the courts not to be like a criminal sanction. It is a criminal sanction. I've dealt with a lot of individuals in that situation. Some of them have to wear ankle bracelets the rest of their lives. You have to show up every 90 days. If you change your residence, if you buy a car, whatever, you have to report. If you show up and you fill out on your registration form the wrong IP address for your electronic device, you're charged with a crime for failing to register, even though you show up. You show up to register at these places where I've been. There's one downtown in Kansas City, and there's no appointment that you show up for. You just show up and wait. So imagine going to renew your driver's license every 90 days to give you an idea. The reason I bring that up is that's the legislative branch putting that power in the executive branch. So a case has come up where that is being challenged. Now, some of you out there might say, well, who cares about sex offenders? They get what they deserve. And I would ask you to pause for one moment, because I'm not talking about what they deserve in terms of punishment. I'm talking about what the deal was when they pled guilty. And when they pled guilty, the deal wasn't registration. And now that's being imposed upon them. So to the extent that they can be hit with that, I want you to imagine everything in the listeners' lives that they could be hit with on a retroactive basis. So the case is going to be decided here soon as to whether or not the Attorney General has the right. So the legislative branch giving the executive branch the right to determine the retroactive application of what amounts to a criminal law.
And can you read the tea leaves on that and sort of get a sense for how you think the current justices may rule?
I am horrifically nervous about it. I unfortunately think it will go in favor of them being allowed to have that law. And so what we then see, and there's a pattern there, we see government functions in a broader sense being delegated out to, like, private prisons, for example. We have this constant delegation down to someone else taking on responsibility for government functions. In this case, we actually have one branch of government delegating to the other. And so the scary part of that is imagine the police officers charge you with a crime and you want to review that decision, and you just go to the sergeant of the police officer and ask him or her to review the decision of an underling police officer. Well, you're not going to expect too much justice there, because it's the guy's boss or the woman's boss that's reviewing. Much like in this case we're talking about, the Attorney General's making the rules and they're enforcing the rules. So the chance of getting an independent body to look at that and to make a determination of whether there's a fair application is a little bit scary.
To me, that seems like it goes directly to the heart of the core constitutional concept of separation of powers.
That's the issue. In fact, there were a number of other issues that took place. In fact, this guy, his failure to register at the federal level, he was actually in custody of the Bureau of Prisons when he was transferred from one state to the other, and they still got him for failure to register. So there's a whole number of other issues, but the Supreme Court said, all that stuff's really great, guys. We want to decide one issue. Is the allocation of that power to the Attorney General, was that legal under the separations of power doctrine that you're talking about?
And that's really, I think, one of the main themes that we're seeing in the Supreme Court now, and that is almost an attack on this notion of the separation of powers and the expansion of federal powers. One of the cases, an expansion of the presidential power, one of the cases that I wanted to talk about was one that was frankly in the news quite a bit this last year, and it's a very hot topic. It involved immigration, and that was the Trump versus Hawaii decision over the so-called Muslim ban. That, interestingly enough, was almost like all the cases we're seeing now, a 5-4 decision by the Supreme Court. And, you know, for those folks who haven't followed that case, what it did was it upheld the travel ban and it suspended immigration from seven designated countries that had been identified by the Trump administration. And those were all, of course, Middle Eastern countries. Interestingly enough, all of the lower courts, including the Federal Appeals Court, said that that expansion of, or that particular decision was unconstitutional. But yet the Supreme Court reached the opposite conclusion. Justice Roberts wrote the decision in that case, and he basically said that under the Immigration and Nationality Act, which was enacted back in like 1952, the president has an incredibly broad authority to decide under that law who's allowed to immigrate into the United States and who's not. And what's interesting is that the court said that the this ban was not an invalid form of discrimination against Muslims. Because if you recall, you know, Trump on multiple occasions said it's a Muslim ban.
Right.
And that was really touted, you know, in the media. He made a very big point of stating it was a Muslim travel ban. But the court said that it was not an invalid form of discrimination on the basis of religion, which I thought was interesting. And Roberts wound up writing that because the law itself gave the president very broad authority, the action that he wanted to take there was going to be upheld so long as it was rationally related to a legitimate government purpose.
Right.
And, you know, I guess we can probably give some of our listeners this whole, you know, constitutional law background of, you know, what's meant by rational basis versus, you know, strict scrutiny. But the rule of thumb, as, you know, as we know, is any time that there is a fundamental core constitutional right involved, typically the courts are supposed to apply what's called strict scrutiny. They're supposed to look at it very, very closely as to whether or not it pass, you know, it can pass muster, constitutional muster. But in this case, they said, no, we're not going to apply strict scrutiny. We're simply going to apply this rational basis test. There only has to be some sort of conceivable legitimate purpose to this ban. And the actual purpose of the law itself is really irrelevant. And so in this case, Justice Roberts in the Supreme Court held that there was a conceivable legitimate purpose, which was national security, which I'm sure we're going to hear in a lot of other cases that deal with presidential power. And so consequently, the presidential power was really, I think, greatly expanded here.
Well, and that's a great case and a great one to bring up because I think it really typifies what we're talking about. And in particular, I'm not sure what evidence was brought to bear in order to prove that there was a rational basis. It sounds almost like that the Trump administration provided some explanation, and they just the court listened to it and said, well, that sounds like it could be. I mean, it's not outside the complete bounds of reality. And so as a result, we're going to find there's a rational basis. Whereas, of course, you know, it made me think, Robin, about an article I read this morning. There's a Saudi Arabian woman stuck in, I forgot, an Asian country right now, in an airport in an Asian country. And she doesn't want to go back. She's going to be killed if she returns back to Saudi Arabia. She escaped from her traveling family, and the men in the family want her back, and she's worried she's going to be killed. Saudi Arabia, of course, produced the most hijackers in 9/11, and I don't believe Saudi Arabia was on that list.
They were not.
Right. So Iran was, and I'm not sure what Iran, the members of Iran or their country, whoever, has ever done the United States. So that would be an example where I'm worried that logic and reason wouldn't work out. It's just, and that's the problem with giving executive branch unfettered discretion, really unchecked discretion, because whatever they feel like they want to do, whatever political position that they're taking or whatever their underlying motivation is, there's no check on that. And that's really the scary part of it, because that's where I go personally to the courts to hopefully receive that protection, or at least have someone else, an unbiased, hopefully, opinion, look at the actions of the executive branch. And it sounds like as we move closer over to the executive branch, there's going to be less checking on that. They're going to say, listen, the executive branch wants to do it. It's in their power. Let them do it.
Well, so hence it's going to be very interesting to see how this new Supreme Court majority winds up taking that on in the future. Because if you really think about it, that idea of having an unchecked executive in power is very, very authoritarian in nature.
Absolutely.
But yet, on the other hand, you also have folks that are within this conservative ideology who also tend to be a little bit libertarian in some respects and proclaim to love things like freedom and and checks on government power and abuse. So they're, at least in my mind, when I look at it, I think it creates a fair amount of cognitive dissonance potentially for, you know, for some of the justices on the court.
Absolutely, and we'll just have to see. Well, it's a toss up, frankly, as to how they're going to decide on some of these cases.
But
go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, going beyond this whole notion of expanded presidential power and expanded executive power, there were. You mentioned earlier there were some Fourth Amendment issues and some issues relating to due process. I wanted to jump a little bit ahead and say there was one actual decision this last year out of the Supreme Court that, frankly, I applauded.
Yes.
And oddly enough, Justice Roberts was the swing vote on it. And that was, it was a 5-4 decision. And Roberts sided with Ginsburg, Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan on it. And it was Carpenter versus U.S. And that was the digital privacy case involving cell site location information. Is that one of the cases
Yes.
that you've looked at, David?
100%. And, it is a really important case. And I sometimes wonder if Fourth Amendment decisions at the highest levels are based upon who the justices are able to relate to or what situations they're able to relate to. So the fact that my guess is all of the justices were able to reach into their phone or their pocket and pull out their Apple phone or whatever and look at all the texts and emails on there and realize, my God, I don't want even my location. I don't want anything about this cell phone to be out there without someone outside the executive branch taking a look. And I do wonder in the back of my mind if that's what happened. But here's the issue with that case, which makes it somewhat unique. Generally speaking, there is a rule in Fourth Amendment jurisprudence that information that you're kind of making available to a third party, you can't generally then seek to protect that information. Now, the best example that I have for that, and it still bothers me to this day, is if you leave your trash outside for trash pickup, put it in trash can, wheel it off to the edge of your driveway, all right, you've lost any reasonable expectation of privacy in that, at least as the courts have ruled, because you've put it out there. You physically put it out there, and someone's going to come collect it. The problem with that, of course, is in my personal opinion, is that may be true, but my expectation in that situation is that whatever's in that trash can is going to go to a dump, and it'll never be attributed back to me. It's not that I have anything bad in there, but I don't want Robin, you seeing what medications I take, or somebody else seeing what magazines I've subscribed to, or what my child is interested in. I don't know why, I just don't want that. The courts have held against that. Similarly, in this case, in the case you're talking about, there's an underlying idea about whether or not the government has immediate access, which is a much lower standard, to phone calls that I'm making. Not the substance of the phone call, but the number I'm dialing. Because when I sit there and dial a number, the phone company has to make the connection. So I'm putting it out there.
And that's creating a record.
And that's creating a record. Right. So that... generally, that's still fine, usually. There's a much lower standard when the government seeks to get who I'm calling because I'm announcing it to the world. This case had to do with whether or not, under that same lower standard, they can go out and get historical data from where I went, from where I went throughout a time period.
And for our listeners who might not know, that cell site location information is actually pretty pervasive. The way it works is that anytime you're carrying your cell phone with you, it's trying to be connected to the network. And so what it does is it pings the nearest tower,
right,
cell tower, that's within your proximity. And a record of that is kept by the cell phone company or by your telecom company. And so everywhere you go, there is a record. It's sort of a geolocation, bit of a little data trace that's created that you can then triangulate in on and sort of determine where a person has been. And, in this case, the Carpenter case here, there was I think the underlying charge was sort of an armed robbery investigation that was going on. And Carpenter was a gentleman who was the suspect in a series of armed robberies. And so what happened was that the police went and got something like 127 days of stored geolocation data from his cell phone provider. And then that data was used to place him in various locations. And that ultimately led to his conviction. And I think he wound up getting something like a 116-year prison sentence for the string, you know, that string of armed robberies. But what was interesting was that Roberts wrote this opinion in the case that by the police going and getting that information, that actually constituted a search within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment. And so consequently, a warrant, search warrant was needed. And what I thought was fascinating, because you mentioned this notion of the reasonable expectation of privacy, that was one of the issues that Justice Roberts honed in on in this case, was the fact that he believed that there was a reasonable expectation of privacy that we had. And that creates some very interesting implications for this third-party doctrine that you've mentioned as well.
Well, and so it's fascinating. So in this case, you know, it's not always, but sometimes these justices like to go back to, you know, 0 hour of the country, right? They want to go back to Lord Fauntleroy of England or whoever it may be. Or in this case, Roberts went back to John Adams and talking about about the revolution itself. The reason I bring that up is I believe, if we're looking for probably predictions, that the same kind of protection that's afforded to houses, this case will now mean that same protection is going to be afforded to cell phones. And so what he said in here, and he was restating or reminding us of a prior decision, the Fourth Amendment protects people and not places. And expanded our conception, this is in a 1967 case, of the amendment to protect certain expectations of privacy as well. What's interesting about that is that's Robert saying that he's expanding the reading of the Fourth Amendment, which, of course, you go back to the originalists, and I don't know if they ever expand anything. If it doesn't say it right in there, if it doesn't say it in there, we're not touching it. And here's Robert signaling here, at least in my opinion, wait a minute, there might be more in this than just what's on the paper.
And let's revisit that after we take a break here for the public service announcements and the Jaws of Justice calendar.
Now the calendar for the week of January 7th. Corey's Network invites survivors of murder to their weekly workshops to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. The next workshop, What Will Happen in Court, will be held Monday, January 7th, 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, Kansas City, Missouri. The church is located east of the Hy-Vee at 40 Highway and Norland Road. For more information and listing of future workshops, call 816-834-9161. Or email coreysnetwork@gmail.com. The Kansas City Chapter of Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty will meet Tuesday, January 8th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. Their agenda will include involvement in jury education in Jackson County and the 3 death penalty trials scheduled in Jackson County. They will also be making plans for Lindy Lou's visit to KC in March, including a showing of the movie Lindy Lou with a question and answer session on March 19th at the Plaza Library. Corey's Network and the Chuck E. Cheese at 18701 East 39th Street, Independence, Missouri, are once again teaming up to help victims of murder. On Friday, January 11th, at 3 p.m. to 10 p.m., 15% of all purchases at the register, including food, merchandise, and token deals, will go to help bury victims of murder. You are invited to help out this good cause and enjoy food, fun, and games. If you have information, call the TIPS hotline at 816-474-TIPS. That's 474-8477. Mothers of Incarcerated Sons and Daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, January 12th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, KCMO. If you have a loved one that is incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. My name is Jamie, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. We want to thank our engineer today, Keith Washburn. Now we go back to David and Robin.
We are back. This is Robin Martinez, and I'm here with David Bell, and we are talking about key decisions and key moments in the law over the past year. We've been talking about everything from the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, the shift in the Supreme Court, but we've been, before the break, we started talking about one of the more important cases, I think, that came out this last year in the realm of digital privacy, and that was Carpenter versus U.S. And before the break, we were talking a little bit about this notion of the third party doctrine and the expectation of privacy that you have. And it goes back to 1976, where the Supreme Court in U.S. versus Miller held that any kind of records that you voluntarily provide to third parties, you have no expectation of privacy right. with respect to those records. Now, why is that important? Because in the Carpenter case, there was this distinction between this idea of an order for disclosure that a court could enter versus actually requiring a search warrant. What's the distinction between that, David?
Sure. So generally what we're talking about, in particular in these cell site cases, is there has to be, there was an act called the Stored Communications Act, and essentially what it required is the government to compel disclosure of certain telecommunications records when it offers specific and articulable facts showing that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the records sought are relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation. Now, where I've seen this in the past, just so you know, would be in child porn cases. So what happens is detective finds through some file sharing program that some IP address is associated with child porn. So what I've seen before is the prosecutor, really without any court involvement, would go to the AT&T and say, "Hey, AT&T, there's a number here, 192.35.75. I want you to tell me who that is." And they would comply with that, and they would give them that information, name, address, and other information. I now have seen it where the courts are now getting involved. But in any event, the question is, what is the standard to which we are going to require the government to prove before we will give them access to someone's personal records that the persons have voluntarily provided to others? And when I say voluntarily provided, and when you say it, Robin, you know, when we go through these contracts, like you go to sign up for a cell phone service, and you get a 500 pages of crap that no one wants to read, and no one does read. Even I don't read it. I mean, it's just the reality of it, because no one's got the time.
This is sad, but I've actually read those.
You have? Okay. Yeah. Well, Robin. So Robin's the only person in the history of the world who's actually read those things. But in there somewhere will be something to the effect of, hey, if government asks, we're sharing. That's essentially what it is in most of these things. And by the way, if you want to change it, good luck and calling up AT&T's general counsel and telling him you want to change paragraph 4.7.1.
The odds of that happening are
zero. The odds of you getting a response, the odds of you even getting the email address of that person are zero to none. That being said, the question is, does the law enforcement have to offer specific and articulable facts that there are reasonable grounds to believe, or do they have to go for a higher standard and to a judge to say that you need a search warrant? We want someone to look at this under the standards necessary for a search warrant in order to permit that disclosure of that information. And so the issue is, well, if you've voluntarily given it to somebody or you've agreed that they've got it or they're storing it, which all of us do every day with records, then do we need the higher standard for a search warrant? Do we need the lower standard that we normally have for business records? And the Supreme Court, and this goes back to my prediction, that cell phones now will rise up to the level of homes in terms of Fourth Amendment protection. This is where the Supreme Court says something different, and this is what Robert said. "But while the third-party doctrine applies to telephone numbers and bank records, it is not clear whether its logic extends to the qualitatively different category of cell site records." Now, let me stop you there for a sec. You know, if you look at my bank records and my debit card, you'd probably be able to tell where I got my gas today, where I got my coffee, where I'm going to eat lunch, and where I'm going to eat dinner, and then maybe where I picked up my dry cleaning or something on the way back. You'd pretty much be able to trace my route. But here Robert says, after all, when Smith was decided in 79, few could have imagined a society in which a phone goes wherever its owner goes, conveying to the wireless carrier not just dialed digits, but a detailed and comprehensive record of the person's movement. The other aspect of this that I think they bring up here is there was a case I think we talked about last year where the police officers put a GPS device on somebody's car, and that needed a search warrant because there was a trespass to get there.
That is correct. That was the, in fact, I do recall that case, and I've got it in my notes for this show, and it was U.S. versus Jones, where the government was essentially prohibited from entering private property to put that GPS tracker on the car without a warrant. And that was an interesting one because it was, if I recall correctly, that was actually a Scalia decision before he passed away.
Wow.
And Scalia looked at that one, though, in terms of private property rights.
Right.
And the idea of your car is your personal property, and so consequently a search warrant was needed to be able to put a GPS tracker on it. But the other case that I was thinking was almost a precursor to the Carpenter decision was in fact, we devoted almost an entire show to it here on Jaws of Justice Radio, and that was Riley versus California. And that was the 2014 decision where you had the Supreme Court ruled that a warrantless search of data on a cell phone is simply unconstitutional. And that was a remarkable case in terms of its breadth. When the court finally acknowledged just the tremendous amount of data that people have stored on their phones and discussed the expectation of privacy that we have with respect to that data. So I'm wondering if really the Carpenter case was almost set up by the Jones decision on GPS tracking, and then the Riley v. California that addressed cell phones in kind of a broader context.
Absolutely, and I think while you know, I've never clerked for the Supreme Court, my understanding, at least of reading, talking to individuals, is that there is there's the long view of things when you're on the Supreme Court because you're not have to worry about going anywhere. So you can see these issues percolating, develop. Maybe some of them are near and dear to your heart. One final line from this decision that I think is fascinating, and this is Justice Roberts. A person does not surrender all Fourth Amendment protection by venturing into the public sphere. That is a tremendously important statement, and I think it's something that I will surely be referring to in the future should any issues, whether it's a cell phone or anything else. To a certain extent, what is my right? What right do I have just to be left alone? Whether that's left alone you coming up and talking to me or left alone and not having to worry about you following me. And I hear people say, well, geez, David, if you're not doing anything wrong, then what's the concern? And I'm telling you, be very careful of that thought process, because what you're doing is you're relying on the good faith of others that are seeking to follow you, that they're on the same kind of wavelength that you're on. And to the extent their motives are different, that's something we have to be concerned about, and that's why we need the protections afforded by the court.
And I was going to say, if you wind up extending that argument to its logical conclusion, you wind up with a system that, much like what China is implementing today with its social credit system, where everything you do is tracked, and any behavior that is outside of what the government determines is the norm counts against you.
Correct. Or, and in addition to that, you wind up with the system that certain politicians out there are doing right now, or saying is just trust me, right? Just trust me. I'll take care of it for you.
How many of us trust politicians? Right.
So that's where we're at with that.
Well, we've spent a lot of time here on the Fourth Amendment and the search and seizure context and the warrant and cell phones. Let's shift gears a little bit to one of the other key constitutional rights that we have, and that is the First Amendment. And I was looking at a couple of the big sort of First Amendment cases that came down this past year, and I kind of referred to them a little bit as First Amendment follies because they were a little bit of a different twist on what we normally think of when we see First Amendment cases. And in fact, Justice Kagan, in referring to one of them, it was the Janus versus the American Federation case, she argued in her dissent that the conservative majority on the court was effectively weaponizing the First Amendment, and conservatives were using it to challenge progressive social litigation or legislation. So let me just jump back there, you know, a little bit and give us some background on the Janus case. It was a 5-4 decision again with the five conservative justices in the majority, and it overruled a prior case known as the Abood versus Detroit Board of Education that was decided back in 1977. What was interesting in the Abood case was that in that case, the court held that non-union members in a workplace received a benefit from the collective bargaining undertaken by their by the unions with respect to their wages, hours, working conditions, benefits, all of those things. And so consequently, if you've got a workplace where you've got both union and non-union members, the non-union members shouldn't be free riders, in effect, not pay union dues, but yet get all of the benefits of the collective bargaining. And so the court in that case basically held that non-union members could be required to pay the share of union dues that supported those collective bargaining efforts, but they didn't have to pay the portion that paid for the union's political activities. And that's been the law pretty much since 1977. Now, what was interesting was the Janus case then that the Supreme Court decided explicitly overruled that, with Alito writing for the court that essentially compelling non-union members to pay for collective bargainings was impermissible compelled speech in violation of the First Amendment. And that was a really, I think, a fascinating use of the First Amendment, one which I don't think most of us really anticipated. That same sort of line of thinking carried over in another First Amendment case, which was the National Institute of Family and Life Advocates out of California. And for some background on that, California passed a law that required what were called crisis pregnancy centers to post certain notices on them. For instance, if they were licensed by the state, those centers were required to post a notice that they that the state of California would provide free or low-cost contraceptives or abortion services to low-income women. Then, if those centers were unlicensed, they were required to post a notice that they weren't licensed to provide health care in the state. Now, what was interesting was that law was particularly passed because there were reports that these crisis pregnancy centers were providing misleading and inaccurate information to pregnant women.
I mean, they were being essentially fronts for anti-abortion movements.
Yes. In fact, most of them were unlicensed and run by, you know, exactly, Christian anti-abortion organizations. Now, what was interesting was Thomas, in that case, wound up writing the decision, and he said that the California law then required speech that was in violation of the First Amendment. And the line that he wrote in there, he said it compelled speech for those in crisis pregnancy centers who disagreed with the state's position on abortion. And that gets into another sort of interesting question of government power to regulate as well. So if you have a healthcare facility, does the government, from a public health standpoint, have to have the ability to go ahead and regulate them? Or is there a First Amendment opt-out based on people's religious beliefs? Now, Kennedy wound up concurring in this case, and he argued that this law particularly targeted pro-life centers and that the government sought to impose its message in place of individual thought, speech, and expression, which goes right back to this theme, I think, of weaponizing the First Amendment to attack legislation that may be progressive in nature.
And when you're saying weaponizing, I guess, let me make sure I understand. You're saying that people with or groups with kind of an ulterior motive are using the First Amendment to get what they want for the underlying issue with really nothing to do with the First Amendment. In fact, this union case, it sounds to me we're not necessarily protecting people's right to free speech. We're coming up with this idea of, hey, we don't want you to be forced to have to say something. And we're essentially, the court saying, you're being forced to say something in these cases, even though the individual on the street may not feel that way at all. Is that?
That's certainly the way it's playing out, because of course these cases are all in almost an institutional context, for instance, a healthcare facility. And I think it goes back to you know, this leads into maybe some of the other cases that, that will probably be coming back up in front of the court this next session. And, of course, one of the key ones that, that I think of is, for instance, the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which court kind of took a pass on. That was the case out of Colorado where a bakery refused to make a wedding cake on behalf of a gay couple, and that case did go all the way to the Supreme Court, but the Supreme Court bounced it back, basically stating that the California, you know, Civil Rights Commission or the Colorado Civil Rights Commission had during the hearings expressed hostility towards organized religion, and so they did not believe that the decision had been fairly rendered
for due process standpoint.
Yeah,
and but let me ask you this question real quick though, Rob. What you think that the distinction between in the cake instance, forcing someone to make a cake versus selling a cake already made. I guess for me, it maybe you could help me through this, help the listeners through this. If I come into your business and you're a cake shop and I say, I am marrying my same-sex partner and I want a cake representing both of our images on there, and you choose not to make it, what's your thought on that in terms of where the law is versus I come in and there's a cake already made and I say, hey, I'm getting married to my partner, I'm going to buy that cake. You don't have to do anything to it. I'm going to go buy one of these two plastic men in a tuxedo, plop them on the cake, and I'm going to use that. I let that be known to the cake store owner, and then they refuse. The refusal to sell the already made cake based on their religious belief, I disagree with. I think that they're required, if they're going to be in commerce, they need to sell that cake. I do struggle with the making you make that cake.
Well, and that's a big, you know, and that's, I think, one of the key reasons why this case is not dead yet and why I think ultimately it will wind up coming back to the Supreme Court. But, you know, and we've struggled with this decision for quite some time. And in trying to figure out how best to handle it, one theory that's been posited is that if you are essentially in business and putting yourself out in commerce, and let's say you set up a business organization, a corporation, an LLC, you are essentially obtaining the benefits of that state statutory structure that is in place to protect you and help you do business. So if you're availing yourself of those benefits, do you then have an obligation to serve the public in the business that you're in?
You know, and that's a great point. And if the conservative part of the court is going to side with business and money, it would seem to me that in that case, that should win out just for the selfish reason. And I'll throw back an example that I think we would all agree with. If you have someone coming in, let's go to that Colorado cake case. We've got a Caucasian male marrying an African-American female and goes in, and the cake owner, in their religion or belief, doesn't believe that different, you know, races, whatever you want to call it, should get together and be married. Surely he would have to make that cake. Meaning, even in the example of where, hey, I want you to make a cake, I want my image on there, I want my partner's image on there. I'm Caucasian, she's African American, I want that image on there. And he says, you know what, religious belief, I don't believe that people should be intermixing, like something we would have had 50 years ago. I think in that case, hopefully, I don't even know really, but the court would say, no, you got to make that cake. So really, what's the difference here?
Well, and that goes, that I think is really an interesting question because it ties right back to the First Amendment question that keeps coming up. What are the limits of the First Amendment religious freedom to essentially act or not act? And that, I think, was the kind of the core question that the court looked at in this National Institute of Family and Life Advocates case about requiring speech. My view, based on kind of where I'm seeing the court head, is that based on this particular decision, I think that when the Masterpiece Cake Shop case ultimately winds up back in front of the Supreme Court, I think that they're going to rule in favor of the cake shop on that one.
To say that they cannot be, not forced, but that they can refuse on religious grounds to make the to produce a custom cake for a same-sex couple.
Absolutely. I hope I'm wrong on that, but just reading the tea leaves based upon the the recent attitude or the recent decisions that the Supreme Court has made in this sort of First Amendment religious freedom area. It's that once again, they seem to be interpreting it in such a way that they are almost taking a maximalist approach to it and saying that as long as you can assert some sort of religious grounds for an action that you either take or don't want to take, we're okay with that.
Wow, that is horrifically scary in terms of what religion is. I do wonder, and you may have a better grasp on this than me, the contraception cases that were coming up, I think it was Hobby Lobby. I know that was a prior Supreme Court term, but I believe they cited in favor of the store in that case.
Yes, indeed. And I think that's a trend we're going to continue seeing, because if you look at the sort of the five-justice majority that we have, it's not only a conservative majority, but it's also a bit of a religious conservative majority.
Correct.
And all of these justices were touted on religious grounds.
Right.
And were almost brought to the forefront and were nominated because of those very sort of conservative religious credentials. And that, of course, can cut both ways. One of the interesting bits of litigation that keeps popping up from time to time is that if you're going to put a case out there that essentially and render a decision that maximizes religious expression, which religion is it applicable to?
Yeah.
And one of the more interesting sort of provocative groups that we're seeing come to the forefront now is an organization called the Satanic Temple.
Huh.
That has actually constructed a big giant statue, and they're wanting to go and now and install these statues in public places, in front of courthouses and public squares. And that's been an interesting, that's, I think, some litigation to watch, because I think that's going to continue to bubble up through the system. And we'll see whether or not the strong statements in favor of religious expression on the part of the court apply when it comes to a minority religion.
And I'll tell you, Robin, I have a feeling how that one is going to go. So it's interesting that it's being paved way by the way is being paved by the conservative religious groups, and all of a sudden the satanic group is coming right up behind them to see how far they can get. That's a great image that you've given me. Thank you for that.
Well, and on that note, we've got a lot more we could cover, but I think it's time to wrap it up. I think we do need to get into the Drug War News Network news and kind of wrap the show. Any concluding comments?
No, I think hopefully we're safe in our phones. We're safe in our houses. We're probably screwed in our cars. And it sounds like if you're on the right side of the religious debate, you'll be okay for the next 10 to 20 years. If you're not, look out.
Thank you very much, David.
Yes, it's the 420 Drug War News. This is a continuation of my discussion with J.S. Raffaele, co-author of Drug Wars, the terrifying inside story of Britain's drug trade.
Do you have the same situation in the U.K.? Is there an ongoing debate about the benefit of drug war?
Well, yeah, there's a few key figures in the media. Four or five who go on the kind of media merry-go-round and are the kind of, rent-a-pundit who comes on and defends the war on drugs, usually by saying it hasn't worked because we haven't done it enough. We haven't hit the dealers and the users hard enough.
Right.
Now, the very funny thing is that the people in positions of authority, politicians, judges, a lot of police, there's this really funny pattern which happens in the UK that, as soon as they retire, I mean, almost like 2 days after anybody retires, they'll write an op-ed in one of the major newspapers saying we should end the war on drugs.
Yeah.
So as soon as their career won't be affected by it, as soon as they're sort of safe, they'll tell the truth. And they'll say, listen, I was doing this for a long time. It's a terrible mistake. And we should change the law. And, there was, the Attorney General, former Attorney General, recently did it. William Hague, who is a real conservative politician here. I mean, I doubt your American listeners will know who he is, but he was a real sort of high-profile conservative politician, and nobody would ever dream that he would come out for the end of Prohibition, but as soon as he retired, bang, there it was.
Well, and that happens a lot over here, too. Not as often as I would want, But it certainly does. Again, quoting from your book, cannot our legislators understand that our only hope of stamping out the drug addict is through the doctors? That legislation above the doctors' heads is likely to prove our undoing, and that we can no more stamp out addiction by prohibition than we can stamp out insanity. I look at it like this. Go ahead, Jeff.
So that's a very interesting quote you just read, right? Because that's, I should say, that's not my writing, what you just read. That what you just read was a letter written in the early 1920s to the Times.
Oh, yes, W.E. Dixon, right?
The Reader in Pharmacology at Oxford, yeah.
Yeah.
It's or Cambridge University. The debate in the U.K. at the time was about how to handle this issue of specifically heroin, but drugs, illicit drugs in general. At the time, Britain had a system which was internationally known as the British system.
To hear more from J.S. Raffaele on tomorrow's report, I'm Dean at drugtruth.net.
Sitting here in my problem, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m. Then round out your day south of the border with Fiesta Musical, Compartiendo Familia, and Compartiendo en Noche.